fuel barge is a way to augment our trucking operation and the ability to transport fuel up to our customer.
For the first time, North Slope Oil Operations receive their fuel via the sea. From Alaska Public Media, this is statewide news on Alaska News Nightly for Friday, September 7th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, a group of scientists is working to find out what the bottom of the ocean looks like.
We had a blank map to start from, and we surveyed the seabed floor along about 1,000 miles along the coast of Alaska.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by ConocoPhillips, investing and exploring on the North Slope and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, unlocking Alaska's energy resources. Stronghearts Native Helpline, offering peer-to-peer support and resources for Native Americans affected by domestic violence. Safe, confidential, and toll-free, 1-844-7-NATIVE. This message is sponsored by the National Indigenous Women's Resource Center.
Fuel for oil field operations arrived on the North Slope by barge instead of by truck last week for the first time. Dave Pfeiffer is the president and CEO of Colville, the company that contracted the barge. Colville supplies about 90% of the refined fuel for oil field operations on the North Slope.
The industry demand has increased and is anticipated to increase. And so a fuel barge is a way to augment our trucking operation and the ability to transport fuel up to our customer.
There's an increasing number of big oil projects being planned and developed on the North Slope right now, especially west of Prudhoe Bay. That's where companies like Conoco have made large oil discoveries recently. Pfeiffer says that bringing fuel up by barge is now possible due to declining sea ice.
The Beaufort Sea has been, in the last few years, particularly accommodating with a lesser ice flow, which has allowed the ability for barges to come in that hadn't been in years past.
He expects barging to become a regular part of the company's fuel delivery system and perhaps even increase in the coming years. Colville typically delivers 20 million gallons of fuel to the North Slope a year, which requires about 2,000 truck deliveries. One barge delivery is equivalent to that of 200 trucks. Pfeiffer says that Colville's interest in barging stems in part from a 2015 event where ice and water flooded the Dalton Highway from a nearby river and held up transport.
No truck was able to get past it for about 18 days. So the supplies ran out, and it was only critical services only that the oil companies allowed to burn fuel.
Pfeiffer says that barging will provide the company another way to get fuel to the North Slope should something like that happen again. A mining company is preparing to apply for permits for an open pit project in the Ambler Mining District. Trilogy Metals is pursuing the mine in an area of the Western Brooks Range the state wants to access with a proposed road off the Dalton Highway. Trilogy Metals President and CEO Rick Van Nieuwenhuyse briefed a Fairbanks Economic Development Corporation group this week on what the company refers to as the Arctic Prospect, describing it as a very high-quality ore body.
It's 43 million tons of 5% copper equivalent, and just to put that in perspective, that's 10 times the average grade of open pit copper mines today.
The Arctic deposit also includes zinc, gold, silver, and lead, and is one of two area prospects identified by Trilogy, which controls a large portion of the Ambler Mining District via state claims and an agreement with Nana Regional Native Corporation. Van Nieuwenhuyse says abundant mineralization has been identified in a 60-mile-long belt extending through the Brooks Range foothills.
There's 8 billion pounds of copper identified, 3 billion pounds of zinc so far, over a million ounces of gold, silver, gold equivalent. And then last year we added cobalt.
Mining development hinges on construction of a yet-to-be-approved 200-mile access route west of the Dalton Highway. The Alaska Industrial Development and Export Authority would issue bonds to build what Van Nieuwenhuyse says would be a gated private road. Van Nieuwenhuyse says the Ambler District prospects are profitable enough to support the $300 million road. The Bureau of Land Management is expected to release a draft environmental impact statement for the proposed Ambler Road in March 2019. Opinions on the road, which would cross gates of the Arctic National Park and Preserve and the new mining development it would facilitate, are mixed. Some point to jobs and cheaper community access to fuel and goods, while others emphasize impacts on caribou, other subsistence resources, and guiding operations. Tribal government groups in Kotzebue and some other area communities have passed resolutions opposing the road. Well, what does the bottom of the ocean look like? A global collaboration of public and private groups are working to figure that out. The goal is to completely map the seafloor by the year 2030. From Alaska's Energy Desk in Juneau, Rasha McChesney has more from three Alaska companies who are pitching in on the effort.
The Alaska Gasline Development Corporation is spearheading a project that could lead to the state getting a pipeline from Prudhoe Bay down to Nikiski in Cook Inlet. There, liquefied natural gas would be loaded onto tankers and then shipped to Asia. But before they could decide if it was feasible to do that, project managers needed to know what the bottom of the inlet looked like. Cook Inlet has extreme tides, giant boulders, and moving sand waves that could potentially bury the pipeline. So they hired a geoservice company to chart it out for them. And it turns out that Fugro, that's the company they hired, is part of a massive effort to completely map the seafloor by 2030. Fugro Alaska General Manager Rada Hajinova told me about it at a recent conference in Juneau.
Surprisingly, the world oceans are not mapped. They just look like they are, but it's just a visual trick.
Yeah, wait, I use that Google Earth thing all the time where I'm scrolling through to see what something is. Are you telling me those maps are a lie?
Those are just fillers. That's what we think it is. It's not based on any sounding or any measurement.
Fugro is partnering with this Seabed 2030 effort to replace those filler charts with real data. To do that, they're doing new mapping expeditions and helping to convince governments, private companies, and other sources of seafloor data to make it public, including the state's Gasline Corporation.
And, we thought about it for a bit, and we said, yeah.
That's Fritz Krusen. He's a VP at the Gasline Corporation.
This sounds like something good for the public, for the Cook Inlet fishermen and for the marine traffic that goes up and down to Anchorage through the Cook Inlet.
Krusen says the state corporation has to clear the request with BP, ConocoPhillips, and ExxonMobil first. They're the ones who own the original data. But he expects the data to be released in a few weeks. They're not the first company in Alaska to pay for marine charting data, then turn it over to the public. In late 2017, the broadband company Quintillion finished installing more than 1,000 miles of cable along Alaska's Arctic coast, bringing internet to communities from Prudhoe Bay to Nome. And just like the state's Gasline project, the company needed to know what was happening under the water before it could install the fiber optic cable. Christina Woolston is the company's VP of External Relations. And she says when the company started its project, there just wasn't a lot of information available about the seabed floor in the area.
We had a blank map to start from, and we surveyed the seabed floor along about 1,000 miles along the coast of Alaska.
Because this is the first time this type of work has been done in the area, Woolston says it adds data that could be used to build functional charts for everyone from fishing boat captains to new private industry in the Arctic. From Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Rasha McChesney in Juneau.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a Sitka artist highlights Alaska Native history in a large showcase.
They offer room for dialogue and progress. They're tools. The work is doing work.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Do you want to work at a job that contributes to the health of your community? Well, Southeast Alaska Regional Health Consortium, or SEARCH, is hiring. SEARCH offers full-time jobs that include health, vision, and dental benefits, as well as paid time off and retirement savings. For more information, visit search.org/jobs and view open positions. Start a rewarding career helping others at SEARCH. Healthy is here. This message sponsored by the Southeast Alaska Regional Health Consortium.
A Sitka man has been sentenced to 45 years in prison for second-degree murder for shooting his girlfriend during an altercation last year. His sentencing this week concluded a 15-month legal drama that began with a romance inside Sitka's City Hall. KCAW's Robert Woolsey reports.
During a heart-wrenching two-hour hearing in Sitka Superior Court, 40-year-old Ruben Yerkes, a former city paralegal, told the overflow audience that taking the life of 28-year-old Allie Clayton constitutes the single worst failure of my life. And he expressed deep remorse over the act and over the trauma he has inflicted on the community.
All that matters now is that Allie isn't here. People are suffering, grieving. as a result of my actions. Words cannot express sorrow, regret, and shame I feel, knowing I took away the life of a kind and loving woman. A woman who should have had a bright future.
The couple met after Clayton took a job in Sitka's finance department. They had only been dating for about 10 weeks when Yerkes shot and killed her. He has already spent 15 months in jail, most of which at the Lemon Creek Correctional Center in Juneau, while the state and the city engaged in a protracted dispute over confidential emails on the computers seized from the pair's work computers. Allie Clayton's father, Steve Clayton, argued that Yerkes was more dangerous than many realized. In the aftermath of Allie's death, he and his wife discovered two weapons belonging to Yerkes, including a sniper rifle, which he had stored in her home, in addition to the pistol he had put to her head and pulled the trigger four times. Judge Trevor Stevens also shared his misgivings over the manner of Allie Clayton's death. Although he believed that Yerkes never planned Clayton's death, Stevens said it was intentional. Yerkes had to walk across the room, open the drawer, and take out a handgun, and then he held Clayton to the bed as he shot her.
It's fair to infer from the record I had before me that she was aware of what was happening. May have attempted to defend herself. It's likely she knew she was going to die. The horror, the terror that he caused her in that moment is simply beyond my powers to describe.
Allie Clayton's mother, Paula Clayton, offered the longest testimony to the court. She said that Yerkes did not deserve another day of freedom. She described the five life sentences that she would now face, including the pain of knowing her daughter faced a violent death, the loss of joy in her family's lives, and most importantly, living with hatred.
I hate Mr. Yerkes with every cell of my body. I despise him. I loathe him. Some people need to say I need to forgive him, to find it in myself, to forgive him for myself. But they're not experiencing this.
Depending on his conduct in prison, Reuben Yerkes will be eligible for discretionary parole in 13 years and 9 months. If the parole board turns him down, he'll be eligible for mandatory parole after serving 30 years of his 45-year sentence. Steve Clayton did not appear placated by this news. Looking at Yerkes, he said, "You're lucky to have the court system protecting you." Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
The Kenai Peninsula Borough is urging the city of Soldotna to seek voter approval in its efforts to annex surrounding areas. The Borough Assembly voted this week to oppose Soldotna's plans, sending a resolution to encourage city officials to allow residents who live in the proposed annexation areas to vote on the issue. Alaska law allows cities to expand municipal boundaries through a legislative review process or through voter approval. The review process requires cities to petition the local boundary commission, which might present the proposed boundary changes to the legislature for approval. The Soldotna City Council drafted a petition to annex 7 areas earlier this summer after beginning a process of collecting information on boundary changes through the legislative process in 2014. Each of the proposed annex areas is small, with the largest at about 1 square mile, according to an online description by the city. Together, the parcels would add just under 4 square miles to the city of Soldotna. The city describes annexation as a way to promote, among other things, the, quote, orderly, high-quality development and the cost-effective extension of public services. School is underway now, but over the summer, 8 Bristol Bay middle schoolers did something particularly adventurous. They attended the Cape Pierce Marine Science and Culture Camp on the southwest tip of the Togiak National Wildlife Refuge. KDLG's Izzy Ross went along and has this story.
On a Monday afternoon in mid-July, 8 middle schoolers, 4 from Dillingham and 4 from Good News Bay, took off in a couple de Havilland Beavers. They landed in the harbor off the Cape Pierce beach.
We're going to move along, stay close.
Camp leader Terry Fuller led the way as we dragged our gear and food through the tall grass to 2 cabins surrounded by a bear fence. Chaperone John Diasek brought up the rear. After the kids unpacked, Terry explained what to expect over the next few days.
We want you guys enjoying yourselves in the outdoors and attaching importance to the environment so that when you are adults and you're the ones voting and making decisions, that you're making good, solid decisions about it. Somebody who never has a chance to come out here is going to have a different perspective about this than you will.
The next morning, the camp began in earnest. The group headed to the beach to see what they could find in the sand.
Wow!
This is why you need to follow directions. First of all, bear tracks, and I believe these are last night. They're fresh. Okay, so
as we walked along the shore, we didn't see any walrus, but we did see a walrus carcass. And the pungent stench didn't deter the kids from taking a closer look.
Do you know what bacalics are? Maggots.
Low tide found us clambering below Cape Pierce's famous arch. Puffins propelled themselves through the air with their short wings as the kids peered into tidal pools. Freedom Thoyer, Kylie Klaus, and Jamal Romy ran down to the shore.
My favorite activity was going down to the beach because I got to jump in the water and trip in it too. The jellyfish, when we were jumping over the waves, we saw a jellyfish and me and Jamal touched it.
It even had a thing like so it can digest it or something. It was like, we just touched the top part.
Fuller said these camps help kids bond with the environment.
Part of my job is exposing people to this so that hopefully they'll make decisions that benefit the natural resources rather than just tear them down. Stewardship is the word.
An important piece of that is having fun. At the beach bonfire that evening, Kimberly Roberts, Melvin Pavla, and Messina Evans practiced their new survival skills.
My favorite thing was our tree.
Trying to start a fire.
Melvin, KJ?
On the final full day, we hiked 5 miles along the cliffs overlooking the water. We saw a host of seabirds, black-footed kittiwakes, cormorants, and murres. Perched atop a cliff, we also saw an enormous bald eagle. Winding down the path on the way back to the cabins, suddenly...
A fog's right there, and it's on a ledge of a rock, and it's just sleeping. And we have to be really quiet, or we'll wake it up, and then it'll run away.
As the sun set and we started packing up, the kids reflected on what they would take with them. For Angelina Olson and Shanoa Shingliuk,
the sand dunes. I love the sand dunes. Despite the sand getting everywhere when you're done playing in it. Oh, because it's squishy.
Interesting, squishiness.
I liked how the grass and the nature made me feel all warm and fuzzy inside.
For Messina Evans, the trip was about new friends.
What are you going to say when you go home? Tell your family.
What the best things I did here, yeah. And meet the people and tell them about the fun people I met and the people I remember.
The next morning, tired, happy, and covered in sand, we flew home. In Dillingham, I'm Izzy Ross.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, offering financial tools to start, run, and grow a business. Learn more at wellsfargoworks.com. You know your teenager is struggling, friends have changed, grades have dropped, and when you try to talk, they argue or ignore you. Don't wait until it gets worse. Take action by calling Alaska Crossings. Alaska Crossings has helped hundreds of teens gain back their confidence and self-esteem in a full, fun, outdoor environment. The program is now accepting applications for troubled teens ages 12 to 18. Visit alaskacrossings.org and apply today. Alaska Crossings, youth succeed here. This message sponsored by Alaska Crossings.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugiak,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow, Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Alaknarechamut.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Dave Waldron. This week on AK, Art in the 49th State. Nicholas Galanin strives to create fearlessly. The Tlingit artist works in multiple mediums from his home in Sitka and has made a name for himself in the indigenous art world. Galanin just finished his exhibit, Dear Listener, at the Harvard Museum in Phoenix, Arizona, the largest by a contemporary artist at the museum in a decade. KCAW's Emily Kwong has more.
I am working on some silver jewelry right now. So this is engraving, and it's gonna be a bracelet when it's done.
At his workshop in Sitka, all of Nicholas Galanin's attention is on a thin and shining piece of silver. Jewelry is where Galanin got his start. At 14, he began carving under the apprenticeship of his father, Dave Galanin. Rubbing oil-based clay on the silver, Galanin sketches a small circle. He brings a pneumatic hand engraver to the metal, moving slowly.
Build it as I go.
And pretty soon,
There's an eye.
The newly born eye of a raven looks back at us. Galanin used to design everything on paper and transfer the image to the silver. Now he trusts his line work and creates freely. His last desk job was at Sitka National Historical Park, greeting visitors.
Nobody was there. I didn't have anything to do, so I drew. And I was told that I can't do Tlingit art drawing there. I could only read Russian history books. So I quit. That was my last job. Like, that was non-creative related.
He's made a living from his art ever since, earning national and international recognition. Singer Erykah Badu is wearing his silver work in her latest Instagram photo. Galanin is a musician too, releasing an album last year with his band, Indian Agent. This is their song, Life Keeps on Spinning. People don't celebrate, 2018 has been a busy year for Galanin, but a lifetime in the making. In addition to the solo retrospective at the Heard Museum, Galanin released a 140-page monograph and led the carving of a totem pole.
That was a big side job. Because I was flying to Juneau and working 3 days a week, 12-hour days to start. And at the end, we were working 20-hour days to finish it up.
But Galanin and his five apprentice carvers hit their mark. The 40-foot healing pole was raised in June to memorialize when the city of Douglas burned down the Douglas Indian Village in 1962. Even when working with traditional materials, Galanin has a call-and-response relationship with history. He tracks on the ways that Indigenous people have been and are displaced, or Indigenous cultures appropriated and commodified. And his work calls attention to that, boldly challenging the viewer and asking him or her, where do you stand? Take, for example, a pair of iron handcuffs, intricately engraved by Galanin with Tlingit imagery. He calls the work Indian Children's Bracelet, in reference to the separation of families through Native American boarding schools.
That's representation of that selective amnesia where somebody will look at these children's bracelets and if they just choose to look at the surface, they'll see the engraving and they'll see the Tlingit art form that they might appreciate and they will not see the full object or the history that that object tells.
And that's one of 50 such works in the exhibit. Galanin flips through his monograph, pointing out others. There's God Complex, police riot gear made out of porcelain. White Noise American Prayer Rug evokes the fuzz on a television screen. And We Dreamt Deaf is a taxidermied polar bear from Shishmaref. His unstuffed hindquarters appear to melt. It's a provocative statement about climate change.
They offer room for dialogue and progress. They're tools. The work is doing work.
Viewers have reacted all kinds of ways, he tells me, some saying the work made them uncomfortable. Opening night was particularly overwhelming. The group Shabazz Palaces was performing, and Galanin was getting approached on all sides.
It was like I walked into a pit of piranhas at the opening and was being fed upon by docents. White old ladies and like, I don't know, they just were vicious. They were like demanding me to explain the work and myself and like these titles and all of these things.
Other viewers, especially Native viewers, said the work made them feel seen and empowered. Dear Listener is the name of the exhibit, and Galanin's fully aware some of his most attentive listeners are his three children. They've seen the home studio in Sitka grow over the years.
Forever like holding new things and new objects, and every object has a conversation, and these conversations we're having now, I have with them.
And that is the most important part for Galanin. Not the art in the exhibit, but the conversations that come out of those willing to take the time, look, and listen. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Emily Kwong.
Now it's time for 49 Voices, and this week we're hearing from another artist, Mark Witteveen in Kodiak. Locals may have seen Witteveen's work around the town in the form of a metal fish.
I am a sheet metal sculptor, so I craft mostly marine-related stuff, fish and octopus and crab and stuff, out of sheet metal. You end up with a pretty lifelike three-dimensional sculpture with lots of depth and motion and color, and so it's kind of a unique medium, and it's really fun. The only real people doing metal shaping anymore are people that build like custom hot rods or motorcycles. There's just not a lot of artists out there that are metal shapers, so it's kind of fun being unique in that way. Usually I do stuff that's popular to people wherever I'm selling stuff. Around here it's salmon and halibut. And I'm a fisheries biologist, so I spend a lot of time with live fish and really kind of get hung up on the details of the pieces being biologically accurate. As far as different types of salmon, a lot of it has to do with shape. Different parts are different on salmon, like the base of the tail on a coho is really thick, and that's kind of how you identify a coho, and the what pigment is on the tail, if it's silver or spots. I think fish are interesting just because of their diversity. You look at, you know, salmon versus rockfish versus halibut. It's just a fabulous amount of variety in the fish themselves, and their life histories are really interesting, and how they behave, how they exist in their world. I think it's really reflected in how important they are. The economy of fisheries is sort of obvious in a place like Kodiak, and as a recreational outlet for people, but then they really become part of the culture. You see, you know, fish in art, fish in subsistence, people putting food on their table. So it's really, fish are really kind of all-encompassing in a place like this, and it's hard to not be passionate about them.
Mark Wittevine lives in Kodiak. 49 Voices is AK's attempt to put every Alaskan on the radio. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Emily Kwong, Kayla DeRoche, and Wesley Early. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Dave Waldron.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Ravenna Koenig and Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Rasha McChesney in Juneau, Robert Woolsey in Sitka, and Izzy Ross in Dillingham. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, Wesley Early is our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, sustaining Alaska's pipeline for 40 years and counting. And by Alaska Heart and Vascular Institute, committing to improving the lives of Alaskans. Using a team approach, Alaska Heart and Vascular Institute offers a range of cardiovascular diagnoses and care. Learn more at alaskaheart.com. Strong Hearts Native Helpline, offering peer-to-peer support and resources for Native Americans affected by domestic violence. Safe, confidential, and toll-free, 1-844-7-NATIVE. This message is sponsored by the National Indigenous Women's Resource Center. You know your teenager is struggling, friends have changed, grades have dropped, and when you try to talk, they argue or ignore you. Don't wait until it gets worse. Take action by calling Alaska Crossings. Alaska Crossings has helped hundreds of teens gain back their confidence and self-esteem in a full, fun, outdoor environment. The program is now accepting applications for troubled teens ages 12 to 18. Visit alaskacrossings.org and apply today. Alaska Crossings. Youth succeed here. This message sponsored by Alaska Crossings. This is statewide news on Alaska Public Media.